afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elodie Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Friday, November 13th, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
TGIF, the 13th, Melody.
Yes, it is. And but you never know, and I've had a great day today. It's been a good day here at Discount Gold and Silver, so, you know, maybe we're going to change that around. Gold had a good day today, so there you go. Poo on Friday the 13th. So, gold today, you know, we're still not touching 1900. Close. We almost got there today, but we're still up $11.30 at 1889 in the New York spot price aftermarket. Silver was up 39 cents at $24.72. Platinum was up 10 bucks at 894. Palladium was down $11 at 2351. The USDX today was down 0.21 at 92.75. Crude oil was down 99 cents at 40.13. And, of course, you know, with all the Wall Street upbeat virus, we got it under control, and Cisco and Disney results to help fuel optimism, and, you know, it just doesn't matter what anything else is going on. The Dow was up 466 points. That's 466.62. So there's your 666, ladies and gentlemen. 29 on, they reversed it. I guess we started too soon. Maybe I'll wait a few more minutes, Dave, before I go back to those numbers until the final ones come through. 10-year yield, 0.89%, up 0.01. And, you know, foreign markets were basically negative overnight. And let's go back to the Dow, 399 points at 29,479. The NASDAQ was up a little, about 1%, 11,829. The S&P was up 48 points at 3,585. And I guess it just doesn't matter, Dave, anymore. And, you know, I was reading a little bit about quant. Is it quant trading?
Yes.
You know, so, you know, I wonder how much that has to do with how some of these markets throughout the day, when we see days like today and weeks and so forth. But I don't know. I don't have an explanation for it other than, and you know what, this virus thing, Dave, you know, as far as the vaccine, it reminds me of the trade agreement with China. One day it's on, the markets went up. The next day it was off, the markets went down. You know, and then the vaccines remind me of the same thing. You know, of how depending on the announcements that are made in regarding the vaccine. So, you know.
Yesterday's news, almost, it seems like sometimes. What else is going on to neutralize it? And yeah, there's just so much noise out there. Any little thing could upset these markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's still a staggering number of Americans that continue to fall into a troubling labor market category. Out of work for so long that regular unemployment programs, they've already expired. And this number of these Americans is rising every week. We have people that are falling off the state unemployment rolls and, you know, likely getting work, but that's being offset by people who are falling off because they're simply no longer eligible to collect state unemployment after 26 weeks. They're transitioning to the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, which under March's CARES Act provides 13 extra weeks of support. The decline in continuing claims exaggerates the improvement in total employment. An economist at Breen Economics, Conrad de Quatros. About 160,000 more people moved into the PEUC in the week ending October 24th, and of course that's bringing that number of claimants to 4.1 million, Dave.
Well, and let's remember too that the PEUC expires on December 26th, which is going to rip financial support out from right underneath millions of people, unless that is, it's extended by Congress, which continues to appear unlikely. The same's true for pandemic unemployment assistance, the program for gig and freelance workers, where over 9 million people are collecting benefits. Now, one possible piece of promising news amid all this bad, over 500,000 people are tapping the extended benefits program. That's an option for eligible unemployed workers in most states, I believe 46, that have exhausted regular and PEUC benefits. That has 21,000 fewer people than last week. But bottom line, Melody, there are over 21 million Americans still receiving some form of unemployment benefits. Yes. That is over 374,000 less than the week before. More importantly, however, it's, to use your word, a staggering increase over last year at this time when just 1.4 million people were receiving benefits.
Wow. Kind of puts things into perspective. It doesn't seem to mean anything, but it kind of puts it into perspective. You know, and to me, you could look at this next topic. I mean, I can read it both good and bad. And I view it as sad because it has to do with the airlines. And, you know, we often talk, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. And, you know, so much is done based more on profits than truly keeping us healthy and so forth. But the airlines, they're hoping that they have a recovery for delivering the vaccines, not people. I mean, the vaccine news airlines have been waiting for kind of arrived this week, raising hopes for a recovery in passenger air travel, but only if the crippled industry can muster the resources to deliver billions of life-saving doses to the world. Now, you know, what's wrong with this picture? The challenge is enormous. Like maybe it's better than the military. I mean, we know our administration has already designated the military. And sometimes it just doesn't seem that the numbers really match what they intend to do. You know, providing a single dose to the world's 7.8 billion people. Well, you know, how many of those are actually going to get it? Less than half. They're planning on everybody. Well, there's quite a few that aren't going to get it. Just providing a single dose, we'll just use these numbers, to the world's 7.8 billion people would fill 8,000 747 freighter planes. And this is from the International Air Transport Association. If half the needed vaccines are transported by land, it would still be the biggest and single challenge the air cargo industry has ever faced. But here's the problem. Most cargo flies in the belly holds of passenger aircraft, not on cargo planes, and one in four airplanes have been grounded during the pandemic because people aren't flying. Plus, how do they keep those shipments in that negative cold that they need?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, the majority of those parked planes are wide-body jets, typically flown on international routes, and they're precisely the ones needed to distribute the vaccines. An added complication? The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and others would require ultra-cold temperatures, as Malady just alluded to, throughout the supply chain. And few airlines are equipped to maintain shipments below minus 13 degrees Fahrenheit. Germany's Lufthansa is an exception, with cold chain capacity in 35 markets. Others, including Korean Air and United Airlines, are scrambling to prepare, but the industry's hardly in top shape to pull off such a massive undertaking. And that means airlines will need, drumroll please, government help. It's according to industry officials. The industry is urging Congress to renew the payroll support program for airline employees that expired October 1st, so they'll be prepared to jump right into action when a vaccine is ready to roll.
Wow. And you know what? Is this where the military comes in, because they are unable to do it? These airlines are just, you know, will be unable to do it. So, I don't know. It's just leaves a nasty taste. There's just something wrong with these pictures. Just something wrong. Here's another one. Controversial nominee Judy Shelton, as she's looking to be within striking distance of getting a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. Her political background is unprecedented for a Fed candidate and threatens the central bank's critical apolitical stance. Of all the tools in the Fed's arsenal, its independence from political influence is the most powerful and most important. I'm not so sure the Fed is really independent from political influence, Dave. Talk like they do, but she is a former Trump campaign advisor, is likely to clinch a position as one of the crucial decision makers, as one of the most powerful economic institutions in the world. Full Senate vote on Shelton's nomination is expected to happen as soon as next week. You know, nobody's talking about this. Nobody. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska revealed she would support Shelton's candidacy, all but guaranteeing Shelton, for now, has the votes to be confirmed. Her economic stance is unclear to Fed watchers. She's flip-flopped between unconventional views before her candidacy to post-election statements that were in line with President Trump. So, but one case in point, she's long supported a return to the gold standard. However, she said at a hearing earlier this year that she would not advocate going back to prior historical monetary arrangement. But she didn't actually say she would not advocate going back to a gold standard, did she? She said historical monetary arrangement.
Those are the words that she used. And she had us there for a minute, Malady. But when push came to shove, I'm sure she was advised she's got to come off her gold standard position. But doesn't mean there wouldn't be a friend of gold were she to be appointed, as it's looking more and more like she will. Now, she's also questioned the importance of the Fed's independence, but at the start of her hearing, she gave a thumbs up to the Fed's political independence and operational autonomy. She's also criticized the Fed for cutting interest rates to near zero in the depths of the crisis, but then advocated for a steep rate cut last year, just around the same time Trump was calling on Powell to slash rates. Now, senators on both sides of the aisle were initially skeptical about Shelton. Senate Banking Committee Republicans voiced concern about some of her non-mainstream views. They also questioned her ability to uphold the Fed's political independence. But ultimately, in July of this year, all the Republicans on the panel voted to send Shelton's name to the Senate floor for a full vote. Now, economist Christopher Waller, he's the director of research at the St. Louis Fed, a far less controversial candidate, also nominated by Trump, did pick up some Democratic votes. No word yet on a full Senate vote on his nomination. Earlier this year, concerns about Shelton's candidacy snowballed into fears that, given the right turn of events, Trump could eventually appoint her to succeed Jerome Powell's chair. Now, that's certainly not likely right now, with the future clouded after January 20th. Her seat, which would expire in 2024, may have little impact among the Fed's 12-member votes in any event, especially if you assume Waller's confirmation. Anything she wanted to do outside of convention would simply be voted down. That's according to Brandon Barford. He's a former Senate Banking Committee staff person. Bottom line, Melody, former Treasury official Tony Fratto says it's not just a question of what damage he could do, which he thinks isn't much. It's that it's a discredit to both the Senate and the Fed. That is her name per se. It screams nothing at all is serious. Not us, not you, not them. Despite that, whether it's a lone voice, minority, or majority opinion, I suspect Ms. Shelton will be sent to the Fed in the next week or so.
Well, you know, she says that she would not advocate. I'm going to go back to this. I just can't let it go. She would not advocate going back to a prior historical monetary arrangement. But she didn't say that doesn't mean we wouldn't be going back to gold. I don't believe the prior monetary arrangement would be adequate or perfect in today's world. It does have to change, but that doesn't mean it couldn't have some sort of a gold standard or where gold would not play a part to it. I mean, even Greenspan was he was a big advocate of gold. You know, but he was the Fed.
Yeah, first. True.
He was
but
a Fed chairman first.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with the latter part of what you just said. I from remembering parts of her July confirmation hearing though, for the Senate Banking Committee, which I watched a little bit of, there were specific questions around the gold standard, returning to the gold standard per se, and that's when she. She didn't say she wouldn't support returning to that. That's when she couched her response in terms of this prior monetary arrangement, which everyone in the room, I would guess, took to mean the same thing. Now, whether, you know, how she'd feel about some hybrid arrangement that involved gold, that's a big question.
All right, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. 2 weeks until Thanksgiving. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. A little less than 2 weeks by one day. Anyway, so let's see.
And you know what that means.
What does that mean?
That means 6 days until the release of the 2020 Beaujolais Nouveau.
Ooh.
Just in time to buy for Thanksgiving.
There you go. Consumer sentiment unexpectedly declined in early November as an increase, of course, in infections. The election. And the University of Michigan's preliminary sentiment index for November decreased to a three-month low of 77 from a final October reading of 81.8. Everyone was looking for 82. The measure of expectations dropped by nearly 8 points to 71.3. And let's see if there's anything else in there that's interesting. Anything you'd like to add to that, Dave?
No, I guess.
Are you okay?
Guess not. No, I'm just looking, looking further in the article, and there's not a whole lot that we've missed by not saying anything more. We can pick up any info that fills any of these holes later in the month when the final tally for November sentiment is reported at the end of the month.
And, you know, the PPI, the Producer Price Index, of course excluding the volatile food and energy components, that rose 0.1% from a month earlier. That's kind of the smallest gain since June. The so-called core PPI rose 1.1% from October of last year. The overall producer price index increased 0.3% from September. And let's see if there's anything interesting. The median economist forecast called for a 0.2% increase in the core index and a 1.2% gain in the PPI, excluding the food and energy from a year ago. But, you know, it only shows a somewhat successful in passing along higher raw materials costs to customers, Dave.
Well, mainstream economists believe these numbers suggest few risks of a surge in inflation in the near future, reaching much less exceeding the Fed's target of 2% on an ongoing basis in accordance with their new policy. If it gets there, is going to be a slow process in any event. Now, producer prices, excluding food, energy, and trade services, again, a measure preferred by many economists because it strips out these most volatile components, which I never really understood, rose 0.2% month to month, although they raised closer to 1% over the course of a year. Now, the cost of goods accelerated, rising 0.5% with higher food prices, accounting for almost 3/4 of that gain. That's about it. We do know that The index for final demand also increased. That monthly gain was traced to higher costs for long-distance trucking, which we talked about on Wednesday's program. That increased almost 2%.
I'm looking at this story from something a little bit different. Of course, we have over 1 million American households are now using their food stamp benefits each month to buy groceries online. So, and their numbers spiked 50-fold this year, of course, after the pandemic prompted the U.S. Department of Agriculture to make it easier for these recipients to shop online. Now, you'll never guess who the main beneficiaries are. Of course, it's Amazon and Walmart.
Ding, 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 ding.
Ding, 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 ding. You win the prize. And they're the only retailers in most states to take part in the agency's online shopping pilot, of course. Now, you know, if you go a little bit into the future, ladies and gentlemen, you could probably see, perhaps, why this is kind of interesting, other than just, you know, the people are now have the access to shop online. Amazon, the USDA program, is an opportunity to get a chunk of the $55 billion that food stamp recipients spent last year purchasing. That surged 20% in the first 4 months of 2020. Amazon is near saturation with higher income U.S. households and has few other sources of new, potentially loyal customers in its most important market. The 1.1 million households that bought subsidized groceries online in September, I mean, it does represent a small fraction of the total food aid, Dave. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, more than 22 million households participated in SNAP in April. And it's probably a lot more today with the increased unemployment. And it's made a difference for people who'd rather not risk a trip to the store. The pandemic is still raging. Of course, Walmart and Amazon are not going to be complaining about that anytime soon. USDA has expanded its online SNAP program, which is now available in 46 states, plus the District of Columbia. Some worry the predominance of just two large retailers comes at the expense of local grocers, although the USDA said in a statement last week that, quote, more retailers would join soon. So expect that probably to go up to 3, 4, hey, maybe even 5, Melody. Target, ShopRite are two that come to mind. Both Amazon and Walmart have been criticized by activists who say the large number of SNAP recipients on their own payrolls is evidence they don't pay their workers enough.
It really is sad. It truly is sad. And I don't know. It's another program for that discussion, but that is interesting. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about silver. Earlier this, I mean, there's trader after trader and analysts, a lot of people. We believe we're going to see gold head to 5,000. We know silver is going to be going higher, too. We know silver is going to hit at least $50 an ounce. And a lot of folks are now beginning to think that might come sooner than a lot of folks have expected. Although it should have been at $50 a long time ago, you have to look at the demand. It really is through the roof. But you don't hear it anywhere except from those dealers on cable networks who run advertisements. That's the only place you'll hear it. And so we're going to just take a look at the demand for silver. We're going to take a look at the mints around the world. And the U.S. Mint has sold 27.2 million ounces of silver. And the American Eagle so far this year. I'll have to go back and, well, I guess last year, they sold only 14.8 million. So that means the demand for silver in 2020 has been running 83% higher. And Well, we still have 2 months, month and a half to go. And we wouldn't be surprised to see the U.S. Mint report a higher silver sales figure, of course, by the end of the year. They will. Look at other major mints, too. They display a similar sentiment. The Royal Canadian Mint, they've been selling a lot more silver than before. A whole lot more. And you got to remember something, too, Dave. These mints have been shut down this year.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, that's a good point to remember. I mean, Canadian Mint, they've seen a 67% increase in silver demand this year. Their volumes up to 7.2 million OZs from 4.3 mil last year. Marie LeMay, who's president and CEO of the Royal Canadian Mint, said over the last several months, the Mint has continued to respond to unprecedented global bullion market conditions, resulting in exceptional financial results for our bullion products and services business. Now, the same Australia's Perth Mint, 69% higher than last year. So while gold's going to boom over the coming year, we know, silver shouldn't be ignored either. Moes Zolfager of the Lombardi Letters, again, he says he'd be surprised if silver doesn't make a big run to $50. So if you own silver bullion and right now and silver reaches $50 next year, as we expect that, you know, at the latest, your gains would virtually double. So for all your gold and silver needs, call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Enough said, Melanie.
Oh, no. That's 1-800-375-4188.
Love it.
You know what? These prices, they're just going to zoom. And, you know, enjoy the quiet now, ladies and gentlemen.
Enjoy
the quiet now.
Seriously, as you said earlier in the week, enjoy the lower prices. Mm-hmm. With the recent corrections, you know, there's the up and down, the gyrations, as Melody has said all along, that you're going to see, we've seen, we're going to continue to see, the clear trend is upward. And, you know, the clouds are within sight. It's really just a matter of when.
So it really is an incredible opportunity for anyone to get in there. We talked about yesterday about 401s. Maybe I was on Beth's program. Maybe it was on her program earlier this week. And, well, I guess it was yesterday. And it's just they're not going to allow all those trillions of dollars just sitting there without some sort of, I mean, Dave, they're just setting this all up, and I just can't believe people would think that this is just going to go on forever without some sort of backlash to what they have. So we're going to move on. We're going to talk a little bit about the negotiations on a new stimulus package. This is kind of like this also reminds me of the trade agreements with China. 1 minute's on, the next minute's off. Markets go up when it's on. The markets go off when it's off. The stimulus. Now, the administration is going to leave it to Mitch McConnell to revive the talks with Pelosi. Well, the White House probably would consult with the GOP lawmakers on details of the relief bill. It's now unlikely to take the lead on talks. The administration would only take over if negotiations have to be restarted completely. So it's, I don't know when they're going to do this. We've seen the $2.4 trillion package proposal earlier this year. President Trump said, hey, bring us a number. Nobody wanted to bring him a number. He was really willing to go higher, but they didn't get it done. So I doubt anything's going to be done before the end of the year, Dave.
I'd be surprised. I mean, Trump committed to roughly $2 trillion prior to the election. A lot of people were surprised that McConnell couldn't be convinced to come together, but apparently he was. He had the ears of, or his ears were hearing from the deficit hawks in his party who were up for re-election. And so he, in support of them, said, not so fast. And even with, you know, Jerome Powell saying that more stimulus is absolutely essential, and said even if, you know, more money than was necessary was approved, it wouldn't go to waste. The impasse continued and continues to this day. So now McConnell's insisting on a much smaller package, talking about $500 billion still as a starting point. That's a sort of a showstopper with the Dems. Chuck Schumer, in fact, said the other day that the $2.4 billion that they've had on the table most recently has got to be the starting place. So you got starting places that are just $1.9 trillion apart, Melody. I mean, what else could go wrong?
What else could go wrong?
McConnell did say earlier this week that he does plan to talk with Pelosi about the funding bill soon. Now, the funding bill in this case is the one that will keep the government running past December 11th. You'll recall in September they passed a stopgap measure to keep government offices open until December 11th. Well, some people think as a strategy, even if it's piecemeal, that there could be components of stimulus relief that could be added to that funding bill that could take government spending through the end of next September. So that'll be interesting to see if something like that comes out. That's the only way I could see something happening before the end of this year.
Well, you know, I just want to touch. Well, we are out of time. We're heading into the break, and the program will return. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231. And the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hey, one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody this third segment as she finishes up some paperwork and attends to some remaining customer business. One story we didn't get to while Melody was here, it's one that's really flown below the radar. 15 Asia-Pacific nations, including China, aim to enact the world's largest free trade agreement this weekend. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, which includes countries like Japan, Australia, New Zealand, aims to reduce tariffs, strengthen supply chains with common rules of origin, and codify new e-commerce rules. Its implementation may disadvantage some U.S. companies and other multinationals outside the zone, particularly after the U.S. withdrew from talks on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, following the withdrawal of India from RCEP negotiations last year, the remaining 15 nations sought to announce the agreement by the end of this week's ASEAN summit, which Vietnam is hosting virtually. Malaysia's trade minister, Osman Ali, told reporters the deal would be signed on Sunday, calling it the culmination of 8 years of negotiating with blood, sweat, and tears. Economist Sean Roach at S&P Global said, while RCEP is shallow, at least compared to TPP, it's broad, covering many economies and goods, and this is a rarity in these more protectionist times. The deal's the culmination of Beijing's decade-long quest for greater economic integration with a region that encompasses nearly a third of global GDP, and the impact could extend beyond the region. Now, we'll see what happens after January. It's a big question now of whether RCEP changes the regional dynamic in favor of China. They say it depends on the U.S. response. That same observer said if the U.S. continues to ignore or bully the countries there, the influence pendulum will swing toward China. We shall see. Now, let me just touch on this piece of news. We've seen a couple of news items yesterday and now again today. White-collar staff reaping the financial benefits of working from home this year and next and in the future in general should be taxed to help other workers who aren't getting the same advantages. That's according to analysts at too-big-to-fail Deutsche Bank. In a report on how to rebuild the economy after the pandemic, the bank is proposing a 5% daily tax on each employee who continues to work from home, which they say could raise tens of billions of dollars for governments around the world. The money would be used, or could be used anyway, to help lower-income workers who've taken on greater risk because their jobs can't be done remotely. That's according to the bank. The bank also noted that the global pandemic has turbocharged the shift to remote work, and that's a trend that's looking more and more to set to last for the long term, with many workers expecting to spend at least a few days of their work week at home, even after the pandemic ends. The bank says these workers benefit from more convenience and flexibility. They also save money directly because they don't have to pay for commuting costs, takeout lunches, or buying and dry cleaning work clothes. But it also means those businesses that have grown up to support office workers won't be able to recover, and the economic malaise will be extended. Now, the bank report does say here in the U.S. the tax could amount to just over $10 a day on an affected individual, and that assumes the average salary of an American working from home is $55,000. They say that such a tax could raise up to $48 billion annually in the U.S. It's certainly not been discussed. A lot of people are just beginning to talk about it, and there's further analysis is underway. Andrew Hunter, who's a co-founder of job search engine at Zuna, I believe that's in the UK, believes the idea is misguided and predicted it would be wildly unpopular. He said it punishes progressive companies and those with kids or caring responsibilities who were responsible during the pandemic, who already are taking on more costs by staying at home. He said, let's be honest, there are many better ways to raise revenue. Well, for now, we wholeheartedly agree. Now, our latest blog, which will be out soon after today's program ends, is about big banks and how the rollback of important regulations are endangering our financial system once again. Listeners can subscribe to our free weekly blogs and newsletters at dgscoins.com, or you can read them on our Facebook page at dgscoins. That's the at sign dgscoins, one word. Yesterday, while preparing for a hearing with bank regulators, the House Financial Services Committee released a memorandum that outlines how the safety and soundness of the biggest banks have been impacted by changes to regulations. Many of the rollbacks or watering down of the bank rules have occurred quietly and without the attention of mainstream media. Taken together, the rule changes are striking in their reckless disregard for the safety and soundness of a sector that blew itself up and us along with it almost just 12 years ago, taking the U.S. economy, the U.S. housing market down with it, while getting propped up with the largest taxpayer and Fed bailout in U.S. history. Well, until this year anyway. The House memorandum, you talk about that? Yes, the House memorandum contains one paragraph regarding the deregulation of derivative swaps that ought to send a shiver down the spine of every American. Here's what it says. The Dodd-Frank Act required most swaps to be cleared, with margin required. Margin also required for uncleared swaps involving financial institutions whose primary regulator included one of the three banking regulators. Initial margin is the amount of margin posted when the swap is entered into, while variation margin is changes in the amount of margin posted over time to reflect changes in the underlying swap's value. In June 2020, these regulators issued a final rule modifying the 2015 swap margin rule, exempting uncleared swaps with inter-affiliates from initial margin requirements, while they did keep variation margin requirements. Fed Governor Brainard suggested, in fact argued, that the rule would significantly weaken a key capital requirement for the largest banks. Now, the House Financial Services Committee has gotten lost in the high weeds. The issue here should not be about posting margin. The issue that's just screaming wildly is that federal regulators would be insane enough to allow an affiliate within one of the serial charged Wall Street banks to be acting as a derivative counterparty to another affiliate of the same bank. The whole purpose of having a counterparty to a derivatives trade is that there's an outside party, one that has the financial wherewithal to make good on a trade, and making sure that Wall Street banks could again bring down big financial institutions with derivatives like it did in 2008 is why the financial reform legislation passed by Congress in 2010 required the majority of derivatives to be centrally cleared. Cleared by a properly capitalized and approved central clearing facility. That was to be accomplished by 2012, by the way. Guess what? It's 2020. And this legislative intent of Congress has been brazenly ignored by regulators and the too-big-to-fail Wall Street banks. Surprised? Well, according to the most recent report from the regulator of national banks, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, this is where things stood as of June 30th. It said, in the second quarter of 2020, 40% of banks' derivative holdings were centrally clear. From a market factor perspective, 51% of interest rate derivative contracts, notational amounts outstanding were centrally cleared, while very little of the currency derivative market was centrally cleared. The bank-held credit derivative market remained largely uncleared, as 36% of credit derivative transactions were centrally cleared during the second quarter of 2020. That's roughly a third. Let that sink in for a moment, ladies and gentlemen. I know this is somewhat technical, if not a lot technical and esoteric. The most dangerous derivatives, credit derivatives that mainly consist of these god-awful credit default swaps, are only 36% centrally cleared a decade after the past, nearly a decade, after the passage of Dodd-Frank. And it's not just the current administration that's thumbing its nose as the intent of Congress when it comes to derivatives. In 2016, President Obama held a press conference with all the federal banking regulators sitting with him around a table, saying this: we are moving in the derivative sector, a huge amount of oversight and regulation, and now you have clearinghouses that account for the vast majority of trades taking place. Not so. So that we know if and when somebody's doing something that they shouldn't be doing, if they're over-leveraged in ways that could pose larger dangers to the financial systems. We know. Not so. A tad overstated, methinks. When the OCC released its data on derivatives for the fourth quarter of 2015, it reported this. In the fourth quarter of 2015, 36.9% of the derivatives market was centrally cleared. Put it another way, the vast majority, over 63% of those derivatives were still being traded in the dark, far from what President Obama had stated. It's clear that the largest Wall Street banks are back to their old habits again when it comes to gaming derivative rules. According to a May 30th report from a trio of European academics, big Wall Street banks were moving vast amounts of their derivative trades to their foreign subsidiaries to evade regulation by U.S. authorities. According to the report, Citigroup had gone from no interest rate derivatives at its foreign subsidiaries in the fourth quarter of 2010 to over 60% by the fourth quarter of 2015. J.P. Morgan Chase went from 0% to more than 40% over the same period. Both Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley more than doubled their foreign subsidiary exposure to derivatives during the same time frame. Bottom line, federal regulators are as clueless today as they were in 2008 when it comes to the level of systemic risk these banks pose to our financial system. And just as clueless as they are, they're gallless, they're shameless, and they lack courage to do what they know needs to be done. The only way to rein in that risk is to literally break up these too big to fail banks, something that should have been done 10 years ago. Restore the Glass-Steagall Act that would separate these casinos from the federally insured deposit-taking banks, thus lessening the risk to taxpayers and our economy. Again, be on the lookout in your email boxes for our blog. It'll be out soon after the show. Now, just a quick epilogue to this story in a minute or so we have left. Banks and investment firms are already anxious about two names they fear in the running to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission, one of the regulators, besides the OCC and, of course, the Fed. That uneasiness started last week when news broke that Gary Gensler, a scourge of Wall Street when he led the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, had been tapped to examine financial regulators for Joe Biden should he be sworn in on January 20th. That fueled concerns that Gensler himself might be in line for the top job at the SEC or another agency he's reviewing. Then Washington lobbyists and industry trade groups got wind of another SEC contender who they would find potentially even more alarming, Preet Bharara, Manhattan's former top federal prosecutor. And with that, we'll leave your imagination to wonder, or better yet, to get on some remote computer and Google this story. That's all we have for today's show. I want to thank you for tuning in, for listening. Melody and I will be back on Monday. Thanks to our engineer Todd for producing today's and all of our programs. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good weekend, and please, safe out there. Bye-bye.